Hi, listeners. If you love Undisclosed, I have two small favors to ask you. First of all, please support our sponsors because they support us. Check out their great products and services using the unique Undisclosed codes and URLs that we provide every week so that we can keep coming back to you week after week. And the second favor I'd like to ask you is this. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and make sure you leave us a 5-star review with a little bit of feedback. That's how other listeners can also discover our show, and we really, really need those reviews. Thanks so much for listening. And now, here is this week's episode.
Sometimes while working on this case, I feel as if I've started on a puzzle, knowing in advance that some of the pieces are probably missing. Only to discover halfway through that not only are most of the pieces missing, but in fact many of them were never made in the first place. The task hasn't been so much figuring out how to assemble the pieces. It's been trying to find people who can tell me what the pieces that don't actually exist were supposed to look like. And the problem isn't this is an older case. Harold and Thelma Swain were murdered in 1985, and yes, in all cases from decades ago, time and entropy are going to play a part in making it more difficult to figure out what really happened. But whether this case was 33 years old or 3 years old, the real barrier to investigating it would still be the same. And that's the fact that much of this case has been preserved only as an oral history, and not in written records. Because for the original investigation, from 1985 to 1990, many of the records documenting what investigators did have been lost. And for the reopened investigation, from 1998 to 2003, little of what was done was ever documented in the first place. Which means that for much of the evidence against Dennis Perry, we're left with nothing more than dueling memories from witnesses, with one set saying that things are one way, and another set saying that they're another, with few or no external benchmarks to compare those memories against. Which is why Dennis Perry may have once had a robust defense to raise against the state's claims, but at the time of his trial, all of it was just one big he said, she said. So, the original investigators say that Dennis Perry's alibi was investigated to confirm, but the investigators from the reopened case say that it was not. The original investigators say that after his photo was put into a photo array and shown to an eyewitness who could not identify him, Dennis Perry was ruled out as a suspect. But the investigators from the reopened case say that this never happened. And these conflicts in the oral history of the case extend beyond the contradictions between the original and the reopened investigations. They also go right to the heart of the state's case against Dennis Perry. Because for all the major components of the state's case against Dennis Perry, there are no contemporaneous records of what those witnesses first said to investigators. For some witnesses, if we're lucky, we may have a short paragraph summarizing what a witness said that was written out by an investigator weeks or months after the interview took place. But for some witnesses, key witnesses even, we don't even have that. Which means, in attempting to figure out where Dennis Perry was on March 11, 1985, we don't have that much to go on. The state claims Dennis Perry was in Camden County around the time of the murders, because obviously he had to be in order to commit them. But in all of the files from the reopened case, there are exactly two sentences on two pages that provide any support for this claim. The investigators say that Dennis Perry's ex-girlfriend told them that Dennis Perry was in Camden County on March 10, 1985, the weekend immediately prior to the murders. But Dennis Perry's ex-girlfriend says that she never said that. Which means, once again, in order to figure out where Dennis Perry really was on March 11, 1985, we're left trying to sort through haphazard witness memories with little in the way of written records to go on. And, once again, I'm left wondering why, in a case where the state was seeking to execute a man, investigators hardly ever remembered to write down what they were doing.
Welcome to Undisclosed, The State vs. Dennis Perry, This is episode 4 of our series on Dennis Perry, who was convicted of a double homicide in Camden County that, before his arrest in 2000, had been a cold case for 15 years. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the book Adnan's Story, and I'm here, as always, with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
If you guys follow me online, you will know that I am a bit of a glutton for beauty products. I love lotions and face creams and potions and serums and makeup and all kinds of things. And when I find something I love, I'll share it online. I'll tweet out a picture. And I'm always asking for recommendations. Anyhow, the point is I'm obsessed with this stuff and I spend a lot of money on it. That's why I'm so excited to talk about our new sponsor, FabFitFun. Now, I've heard about this box, I've heard about this plan before, but I never tried it until a couple of weeks ago. And let me tell you, my mind is blown. First of all, this is the way it works. FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box that delivers full size, not sample size, full size fashion, beauty, home, fitness, and wellness products. They send it to you 4 times a year for $49.99 a box. And can I tell you, it is an incredible bargain because these boxes retail for well over $200, sometimes $275, sometimes more. For example, the fall box that's coming out, it retails for over $275. A few things that I got in my box a few weeks ago and I was just floored by are products that I actually love and use. First is an Ahava Dead Sea Mineral Water Hand Cream. I love a good hand cream. This thing retails for $24 just by itself. There is an Ish Lip Statement Palette. It's gorgeous. I've never used that product before. Retails for like $30-$40 by itself. There are these Tula Probiotic Skin Treatment Pads, which are just amazing. And yes, they retail for more than a box. They retail for like $50 by themselves. So the box itself is an incredible bargain. Also, every single box includes a Glam Glow Bubble Sheet Mask, a Beauty Blender in Pro, Original, or like all kinds of different options they have. And every single member who signs up can get either a Vince Camuto Luck Tote in Black or Red Desert. That is a retail value of $128. Or a Crown Brush 6-piece brush set. And you know how expensive a good brush set is. This brush set retails for $75. Once again, the total retail value of the fall box that's coming up is $275. It can go all the way up to $400 depending on your selection. And beyond the box, a FabFitFun membership includes so much more. You get members-only sales on top of getting great products for incredible value. And also, by the way, it's like Christmas because you open it up and you're excited. You have no idea what's going to be there. And they just send you amazing products. But also FabFitFun members get access to exclusive sales from all the amazing brands that their partners put on. You can get up to $70 off. You can also have access to FabFitFun TV, whether it's Cooking with the Housewives or Toning Up with Jillian Michaels. Oh my God, I love Jillian Michaels. FabFitFun members can work out and eat right with the help of FabFitFun TV anywhere, anytime. And there's new content added monthly. So sign up for FabFitFun today to get your fall box. The FabFitFun fall box is in limited supply, and these boxes usually sell out. Use our code UNDISCLOSED to get $10 off your first box. Just go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well-lived. Once again, use promo code UNDISCLOSED to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 for only $39.99. Go to FabFitFun.com and use code UNDISCLOSED to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box. In August of 1998, when Deputy Dale Bundy first went to Jacksonville to interview Dennis Perry, Dale Bundy straight up told Dennis why he was there. "You're a suspect in the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain," he said, "and I am investigating you. And if you do happen to know anything that might prove you didn't do this, well, you better help us out." That first interview was not recorded, but at a second interview, about 6 months later, Bundy told Dennis Perry one of the reasons why he was a suspect. People say you were in Camden County at the time of the murders.
"I'm not calling you a liar. You know, it's one thing. Why are all these people coming to Camden and saying you were in the area?
These are people you knew.
These are people that have named not a guy, but have named Dennis Perry as equals his grandson.
I was there. I don't know.
I was not there, and I don't know nothing about it. The only thing I know is what my grandmother told me, and I seen on Jesus. And that's all I can tell you.
After his first interview with Bundy, Dennis Perry and his wife, Karen, began calling Dennis's family and friends, trying to figure out what was going on, what he should do, or if they could help Dennis figure out where he'd been on March 11th.
We just blew it off. I mean, we ignored it. I mean, it was like, it's silly. I mean, really? This is like 14 years later. Who in their right mind can remember that I was sitting on the pot at 3:37 in the morning on a given day in month? I mean, it was ludicrous.
That's Clayton Tomlinson, a close friend of Dennis Perry's. Dennis's brother Daniel had a similar reaction.
We didn't talk about it until 1998. And then I said, this is crazy, y'all. You know, and they kept investigating and coming to our house and talking to us. And then I thought, this is serious. And I got really upset, you know, at that point. And then I started paying attention.
When the investigators kept coming back to their doorsteps and made it clear that this investigation was not going away on its own, Dennis's friends and family began trying to figure out where on earth Dennis Perry had been 14 years earlier on some random Monday evening in March. When he was interviewed by Dale Bundy in September of 1999, Clayton told Bundy how they all worked together to try and piece things together.
All I know is he called and he was scared and he was trying to figure out where he was. He said, you know, where was I? What was I doing? You know, we're piecing all in our heads together when we last saw each other around this time and where, what we were doing, where I was living, where was he living. He didn't know. I need to try to figure out and remember what's going on because I'm being questioned about this time period of my life. So it's like, okay. And we started going and hashing it.
The first thing they figured out was that this murder had taken place around the time Dennis Perry had injured himself by falling out of a tree.
And Dennis had injured his back and was trying to get going back into the history, trying to rewalk the path where he was at.
In September of 1998, they pulled Dennis's medical records and discovered that his accident had happened in December of 84, before the murders. The medical records meant that Dennis Perry couldn't have been living in Camden County at the time this all happened because he'd already moved back to Jonesboro with his mother. And from there, Dennis's friends and family found three more events that they could use to triangulate this time in their lives.
I had just gotten out of service in February of 26th of 1985, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when the murders happened right after that.
So right
and
then.
I knew where I was during those few weeks because I was out house hunting in Jonesboro, Georgia. And I just happened to know where he was. You know, they didn't even ask us until 13 years later. And then they were wondering how I remembered that. I said, because that's when I got out of the service.
That's how Dennis's brother, Daniel, realized he'd actually been staying with Dennis and his mother in Jonesboro at the time of the murders.
I owned a house in Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to sell it. My wife and kids were still there. So I would take some trips down here to try to find a house. And when I was here, I didn't get a hotel. My mom wouldn't let me, so I stayed there with her. I would have rather got a hotel, but you know how it is.
And then Dennis's friend Clayton realized two more things. He'd left Jonesboro and gone into the Army not long before all this happened, so he'd been living in Texas at the time. But for his first week of leave from the military, he'd come home to see his mom for her birthday.
At the time, we had pinned down that Danny was home. I'd come home and brought Dennis. Me, Dennis, and Danny came to my house and put together a hat coat thing for my mom's, her birthday.
And this was an event that Daniel Perry and Clayton's mom, Donna Nash, all remembered. The night Clayton had given his mom a hat rack.
And we were all driving around and there's a quarry there. We would drive up in that quarry and we would all just sit around there and party. You know, they were a lot younger than I was, and I was kind of watching out for them, making sure they didn't get in trouble. And it was his mother's birthday, and he had bought her a hat rack thing that you put together, or some kind of thing you put at your front door where you hang airplane. And it was wooden. You had to put it together. So we had to all stop by there while he was doing that on her birthday. So we went in and said happy birthday and all, and he put that thing together and put it in there. And I remember that night because it was her birthday. It was one of the few things I had remembered back, you know, after the fact. Kind of things you don't usually remember, but mm-hmm. when you're thinking back after something like this, you try to remember everything.
My son was here from Texas, Dallas, Texas. He was in the Air Force. Dennis Perry's brother had just been released from the Army in North Carolina. I get a doorbell ringing at 8:30, and here's two drunks and the brother standing there, and they're giggling. They had been out drinking, but they had this old, they had bought me a tree stand, a coat stand from Thrifty Drugstore. I have a great memory. I got a memory like an elf.
Wait, they brought you a what? And
they bought me a coat rack. It was $19.99 at Thrifty Drugstore. I mean, the ugliest thing you could have. I couldn't even give it away for 30 years. It had to be used for firewood, I'm sure. But Dennis and Clayton were drinking, and they were giggling. And I said, shh, your dad's home, Clayton. He's asleep. So Dennis Perry introduced me to his brother, Danny. I had him come in the kitchen, and I said, now, you guys cannot be loud. And Danny was the driver, so he wasn't drinking. And when the two boys got together, it was chaos. I mean, they couldn't do anything but be silly.
That's why when Dale Bundy went to interview Dennis's brother Daniel for a second time in May of 1999, Daniel told them that he knew where Dennis had been at the time of the murders. Dennis had an alibi. They put it together and found out where Dennis had been when the crime had taken place.
There's some things that I figured out since I talked to y'all last.
When was that?
Well, the day that thing happened, and I didn't know which day this was, I knew, and I had mentioned to y'all, but around that time I was with him and a friend of his, and there was not very many times I was with both of them in my life.
Uh-huh.
And this particular time, Clay Thompson's mother, it was her birthday. That was the day, her birthday is the day that man got here, Daniel. So that put them here.
Yeah,
during that time.
Okay.
Now, I don't know what time they were going on. I don't know what they know about that stuff. But I know that day he was with me until about 1 o'clock that morning. And we got in late because my mother locked the door at 1 a.m.
You don't remember what you did after the party? You just remember getting in?
There wasn't no party. We were just running around.
I mean, y'all went to that birthday party.
There wasn't even a party. It was just he was dropping by and okay. put that thing together for us. And then we went out, more or less, for it.
Now, there are two problems with this alibi. The first is that there's no way to be completely certain now whether the hat rack even happened exactly on Clayton's mom's birthday or if it maybe happened around the time of her birthday, maybe a few days before or after. Because the murders at Rising Daughter happened on a Monday, and Donna Nash, Clayton's mom, told the police that the day the boys had come by with a hat rack had probably been on a weekend because, well, she wouldn't have had a party on a weekday.
But you don't know for sure.
No.
Well, like I say, it has to be Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. It would have to be one of them 3 days. It would never be during the week because I work.
So you never have your, like if your birthday falls in the middle of the week, you have your party.
No, because both my husband and I work.
But Daniel Perry's confident that this whole hat rack thing, the time that he and Dennis and Clayton went to Clayton's mother's house, had actually happened on Clayton's mother's real birthday.
Yeah, because we didn't want to do it, and it was her birthday, and he had to do it.
Oh, so you recall it being like it had to be that date.
Yeah, because we didn't want to do it. We were heading out, you know, to the quarry and just messing around.
Okay.
Lordy mercy, I never put that together.
But even if the hat rack trip really did happen on Clayton's mom's actual birthday, well, there was an even bigger problem with the hat rack alibi. Because after Daniel Perry told investigators that Dennis Perry had an alibi, the investigators set off trying to figure out ways to disprove it. And it didn't take them very long to do so. They discovered it as soon as they spoke to Clayton's mom, Donna Nash.
What I want to do is say that he was, you know, involved with murder or homicide
right.
down in Camden County. And he had said that he was here the night of the shooting. Is your birthday on March 12th?
March 12th is my birthday.
Okay. 12th.
But the boys came with a tree, you know, a hat stand, but a tree. They brought that in for my birthday present.
Donna Nash's birthday was on March 12th. The shootings were on March 11th. In 1998 and 1999, when trying to figure out where Dennis Perry had been on the night of the murders nearly 14 years earlier, Dennis and his friends had gotten mixed up and had come to believe the murders had actually occurred on Tuesday, March 12th, not Monday, March 11th. And so, although they thought Dennis Perry actually had an alibi, the alibi they discovered had been for the wrong day.
We didn't have what they considered proof. So it wasn't viable. It wasn't the information that they were looking for.
While Dennis Perry was unable to prove exactly where he was on March 11, 1985, one of the few facts in this case that no one disputes is that in March of 1985, Dennis Perry was living in Jonesboro with his mother, a half-day's drive from Rising Daughter Baptist Church down in Waverly. Still possibly could have gone down to Camden County for a visit, and him doing so wouldn't have been especially unusual. After all, Dennis Perry had family in Camden County, and at the time, a girlfriend down there as well. But Dennis also didn't have a car. Which means he was down in Camden County, the state needed to explain how he got in there. And that's where Dennis Perry's girlfriend Carol Ann comes into the picture. Carol Ann, who is better known by the name Buzz, had dated Dennis for 2 years. But at some point in 1985, they had broken up after Dennis moved down to Jonesboro. Carol Ann's mother, Jane Beaver, was the star witness at Dennis Perry's trial. But Carol Ann herself had little to say that was of interest to prosecutors. And Carol Ann also didn't have anything bad to say about Dennis Perry. She and Dennis had not remained in contact after they broke up in 1985, and by the time of Dennis's trial, Carol Ann hadn't seen him in, by her own estimate, about 100 years. But when she was asked in the witness stand how she'd known Dennis, she answered, "He was my best friend." She had no complaints to make about him. So Carol Ann was only ever intended to be a very minor part of the state's case against Dennis Perry, because there was really only one thing that Carol Ann knew that might have any relevance to the Swain case. And that was about a phone call that Dennis Perry had made to her one day in 1985 while he was down in Camden County. She testified that,
"Yeah, Dennis called me, but he was calling to say hello because he didn't have time to stop. He had come down to pick up some things or something. He was turning around and going right back to Jonesboro."
Basically, Carol Ann said, Dennis Perry had just been calling her to say hello. She remembered that he called from his grandparents' house, who was only just around the corner from where she lived. But for some reason, he couldn't come see her in person. Carol Ann couldn't recall exactly why Dennis had been stopping by Camden County in the first place. Maybe to pick up some things or something, but she thought maybe Dennis had told her that his brother Daniel had driven him down in the back of his motorcycle or something like that. Maybe that's why Dennis had said he was leaving again that same day, because he'd had to catch a ride back with Daniel. Although Carol Ann also remembered that in the call, Dennis had told her he'd had to break into his grandparents' house because he had nowhere else to stay, which seems to suggest he'd actually been staying the night, although this discrepancy is never really explained. There are two records of the police interviewing Carol Ann before trial, and in the reports on both of those interviews, as well as in her trial testimony, Carol Ann's story about the phone call is basically the same. There's only one detail that's not consistent in all three statements, but that detail is the only part of Carol Ann's story that actually matters, and that's when Dennis had made the phone call to her. Because according to the state, Carol Ann told police in both interviews that this call had been made the weekend before Harold and Thelma Swain were killed. There are no recordings of these interviews. Only Bundy was at the first interview, and he never recorded anything, and although Agent Rhodes was at the second interview, and he usually secretly recorded interviews, for some reason he hadn't recorded this one. When asked why he hadn't, Agent Rhodes testified that although he knew that Carol Ann's statement would be critical evidence against Dennis Perry, the thought of recording the interview had simply never crossed his mind. There's no recording of what Carol Ann told Bundy and Rhodes in that interview, but 6 days later, Agent Rhodes wrote up a memo of what Carol Ann told him, and according to that memo,
"Carol Ann stated that she dated Dennis Perry for approximately 2 years, beginning in March 1983. Carol Ann advised on March 10th, 1985, she remembers receiving a telephone call from Dennis Perry. Carol Ann advised she was not dating Perry at this time."
Which is why at Dennis's trial, prosecutor John Johnson called Carol Ann to testify. to place Dennis in Camden County the day before the murders. But this part of the case didn't work out exactly like John Johnson had planned, because when Carol Ann was asked about when the phone call from Dennis Perry had happened, Carol Ann gave a very different answer from what's written in the interview summaries.
I can't tell you when the telephone call was. I don't know a date.
Three more times, the prosecutor asks Carol Ann what date she'd told the police officers that Dennis Perry had made the call, and three times Carol Ann says she doesn't remember a date. Finally, John Johnson made his question as specific as possible, trying to get Carol Ann to confirm the exact date of the phone call she was talking about.
Okay, I understand that. I guess I'm being specific about my question. State whether or not you told the officers that it was on March 10th, 1985, that you used those words, March 10th, 1985.
I would have to say no.
Okay, I have nothing further, Your Honor.
On cross-examination, Dennis Perry's attorney, Dale Westling, asked Carol Ann about her prior interviews with the investigators. She answered that she hadn't much liked how Deputy Dale Bundy and Agent Rhodes had questioned her. It had felt like they were putting words in her mouth, she said, trying to get her to say specific things they wanted her to say. And in particular, she hadn't liked how Dale Bundy had questioned her. Carol Ann told the court, quote, "He was insinuating I knew more than I did, and I didn't know anything." Having struck out with Carol Ann, prosecutor John Johnson decided to go for a backup method of introducing evidence that Dennis Perry had been in Camden County around the time of the murders at Rising Church. He called GBI agent Ron Roach to the stand and had him repeat what had been in his report on his interview with Carol Ann. He testified that when I interviewed her, she told me this call had happened on March 10th, 1985. That date specifically.
Question, you were a policeman at the time. Law enforcement?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and you had a witness tell you and an investigator 13 years and 8 months ago, in the afternoon, I received a call from Dennis Perry, and he said such and such. And you never once said to her, how do you know it was that date?
I never said that to her. No, I didn't.
Here's my question. Did you and Detective Bundy, when this woman said, hey, I remember something that happened 13 years and 7 months ago, did you take any steps to independently verify the accuracy of her information or her memory?
No, sir, I did not.
And so, even if Carol Ann says she did not and could not have told investigators that Dennis Perry had called her on March 10th, 1985, because by the time she was asked about it in 1998, she didn't have a clue what date that call had happened on, the prosecution hadn't needed Carol Ann to get an evidence that this call had happened exactly one day before the murders. That was the date written in Agent Rhodes' summary of the interview, and the jury found that to be sufficient evidence to prove that Dennis Perry had been in Camden County at the time that Harold and Thelma Swain were killed.
Ann was ultimately shaky on the dates and would not testify that Dennis Perry had been in town on the weekend of March 10, 1985. She did at least give the state a way to answer a question and hadn't otherwise been able to answer. How exactly did Dennis Perry get from Jonesboro to Camden County in order to kill Harold and Thelma Swain at Rising Daughter Baptist Church? Because Dennis Perry had no way of driving himself there.
He would have had to sneak out.
Without all of us knowing it, because he didn't have a car, he never owned one, and one of us always had to take him somewhere, and he lived with Mama.
According to Carol Ann, the answer was simple. Dennis had come down on a motorcycle, which meant investigators were in luck, because on the week that Harold and Thelma Swain were killed, there was not one but two possible motorcycles that might have been available for Dennis Perry to use. Because in March of 85, Dennis's brother Daniel had just left the military, and he had come down to Jonesboro from North Carolina to do some house hunting. And Dennis's best friend, Clayton, who was stationed down in Texas with the Air Force, had been on leave that week and had driven back to Jonesboro for his mother's birthday. And both of them had driven their motorcycles to get there.
Clayton drove home on his, on the, Spaghetti Austin special when he came on leave, because he got a ticket at Six Flags. Yes, he did. I remember that.
I came down there with my motorcycle because it was cheaper on gas.
And both Clayton and Daniel are adamant that the only way Dennis could have been traveling on their motorcycles is if they had been the ones driving and were giving Dennis a ride.
Let me tell you this. He never rode my motorcycle except one time right there in front of my house in the driveway. He said, let me take it up to the corner. It was a stop sign. And he took it up there. And he turned around and brought it back, And when he got back in the driveway, he dropped it. And I said, you are never going to touch my motorcycle again. He scratched it up, and I picked it up, and he never touched it again, I'll tell you that.
Which is why Dale Bundy and other investigators were pretty sure that Dennis Perry had not been alone when he came back to Camden County, and that in committing the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain, he must have had an accomplice, or at least an accessory after the fact. To them, the only question was whether it had been his friend Clayton or his brother Daniel.
Clay Tomlinson and Dennis Perry had been close friends since they were teenagers, and through that friendship, their families became close, and they were also close with each other's families. Close enough where Dennis probably talked to Clayton's mother more often than Clayton did himself. Even as adults, if Clayton had forgotten to call home for a bit, Dennis Perry would be the one to call him up and tell him he ought to call his mom more often.
Oh, gosh, this is... And I had just found this picture not too long ago.
That's Clay Tomlinson describing an old photo of him and Dennis together that he's kept around. Doesn't seem to be a photo of any particular event. It's just the two of them sitting on a couple of lawn chairs pulled up in someone's garage. Dennis has on a cowboy hat, and in the photo, his head is thrown back mid-laugh.
The thing about the picture is he's got the laugh of life like he always had. And I'm looking at him like I'm looking up to him. And that's how I've always felt about him. I've always been the one with the feet on the ground kind of thing. And both of us have been wildcatters. You never messed with one without messing with the other.
That's part of why they were always so close, Clayton says. Dennis was fiercely loyal to his friends, and if you needed him, he was there for you.
Dennis is the person you want in your corner, because he was always in your corner.
Clayton told Dale Bundy similar things back when he was interviewed by the police.
If Dennis called me and told me he needed help, he knows that I'd be there in heartbeat for him, and vice versa. I know if I need Dennis, he'd be there in heartbeat.
And for an investigator working a homicide case, the existence of that kind of close friendship can also be seen as something more sinister. And as law enforcement officials learn more about Clay Tomlinson, that's what happened here. To Dale Bundy, Clayton Tomlinson is likely the answer to some of the still unresolved details in the Swain case.
Actually, I don't even know what the motorcycle thing is. Like, why is there motorcycles involved in the case?
That's how he got to Camden County that weekend.
Okay. Whose were they?
It was a motorcycle he rode down here, supposedly with a friend of his named Clayton Tomlinson from Texas. We went out to Texas and talked to Clayton. He lawyered up on us.
So they both, like, they shared a motorcycle, or you don't?
He rode down here on the back of a motorcycle from Atlanta.
Do you know whose motorcycle it would be? Or?
Clayton Tomlinson. That's what Dennis is. Clayton Tomlinson wouldn't talk to us. He lawyered up. He wasn't a suspect at the time, but he's still lawyered up.
Do you think he might have been there, or you don't?
Those bangs you hear are Dale Bundy shrugging in a sort of heavily emphasized who knows gesture. While it's clear that Bundy thinks there's a very good chance that Clayton Tomlinson was Dennis Perry's accomplice in the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain, Bundy also knows he doesn't actually have any evidence to back this up. And so he seems content to leave it at that. But if you think Dennis Perry is guilty and that he killed Harold and Thelma Swain, Clayton's involvement does seem to tidy up some loose ends for the case. For instance, it solves the problem of explaining why Dennis Perry would have left Jonesboro during that brief week while his best friend was home on leave.
Clay was home for a week on his first leave.
Somebody hung out a lot during that week.
They were inseparable.
That's Clayton's mother, Donna Nash. She told Bundy that while Clayton had been home, Clayton and Dennis had done everything together.
That particular weekend of your party, did you know if Dennis and Clay hung out most of the weekend?
The whole weekend.
And if Donna Nash is right about that, well, that would mean Clayton and Dennis had been together at the time that Dennis must have been down in Camden County, if he's the one that committed the murders.
So, even if Clayton Tomlinson had not officially been a suspect in the case the time that he was first contacted by Camden County law enforcement, he seems to have unofficially been one. In September of 1999... Dale Bundy came out to Texas for the first time to interview Clayton. And Clayton remembers that when Bundy came out there to talk to him, One thing Bundy had been really interested in was whether or not Dennis Perry had ever used Clayton's motorcycle.
They weren't getting anywhere, and they threw out at me, well, they were looking at their paperwork, and they go, is this your motorcycle? And I said, yeah. They said, and this is 1984 Kawasaki GPZ 900. And he says, well, we have information that Dennis was riding this bike during this time. I said, this conversation is over. I said, for one, you're sitting there bone-faced lying to me, because I can tell you right now, ain't nobody in this entire world who's ever rode any of my motorcycles, let alone this motorcycle, but my daddy. Y'all are on a witch hunt, and I said, unless you're arresting me, I'm out of here. I'm done. I'm done with this.
But talking to both Dale Bundy and Clayton Tomlinson about this interview in Texas was a good reminder of just how inaccurate memories can be 10 or 15 years later on. Because Clayton Tomlinson told me about getting upset during this interview when he was asked about the motorcycle. And Dale Bundy remembers that Clayton was hostile and straight up refused to talk to him at all. But that's not what happened, at all. They're both remembering wrong. Dale Bundy did interview Clayton, and that interview was recorded, and everything about it was perfectly cordial. Bundy never outright accuses Clayton of being an accomplice to murder, and Clayton was fully cooperative through the whole interview, answering all questions Bundy asked him, and there's no sort of drama to any of it. Here's the exchange between Bundy and Clayton about what kind of motorcycle Dennis Perry might have been using to get to Canton County.
Did he ever borrow your motorcycle?
No.
Someone had knowledge of Dennis being in Camden County on a motorcycle along about that same time as Mark's bike. Whose motorcycle was it?
You can hear Dale Bundy ask, did Dennis ever borrow your motorcycle? And when Clayton says no, he says, well, there's information that shows that Dennis was there on a motorcycle. Whose was it? And Clayton Tomlinson tells him, I have no idea. So, despite Clayton Tomlinson and Dale Bundy both having memories of this interview being something of a tense and uncooperative encounter, there's just not really much indication of that from the recording. And Clayton certainly did agree to talk to Dale Bundy, despite Dale Bundy's memories now that Clayton wouldn't talk at all.
One reason that Clayton Tomlinson and Dale Bundy may have both recalled this interview as being somewhat hostile, when in fact the recording itself seems to show everything was perfectly friendly, is because of what happened after the interview was over. Later on, things did take a more contentious turn, and Clayton Tomlinson did go and lawyer up. But that had been because of what Clayton Tomlinson had found out when he returned home that evening after his interview with Dale Bundy.
I went home, and my wife was at home. We both arrived, and we both had like a ghost on our face. And it's like, you would not believe what just happened to me today. And she says, well, you won't believe what happened to me. And I was like, what are you talking about? She says, I was at the police station. I said, well, I was at the police station, too. They had us both at the police station at the same time in different rooms. And they were telling her that she didn't know me. She said, you don't know Clayton's past, and you don't know Dennis. You all have just been recently married. They were scaring the crap out of her.
Immediately after Clayton Tomlinson was interviewed, his wife had been interviewed as well, although Clayton hadn't realized it at the time. And the officers interviewing her had strongly suggested that she just married a murderer and asked her to report back to them on any sort of contact that her husband might have had with his friend, Dennis Perry. Clayton, of course, was livid.
The biggest, angriest thing of all was them doing what they did to my wife and what they told my wife with my family. That was the wrong thing to do. To try to put that kind of mindset into a family to create dissension amongst the relationship of my marriage, they don't have the right for that.
So Clayton Tomlinson went to a local attorney he knew to ask for help, and he lawyered up, Saul Goodman style.
So I went to Mickey Shyrock and I told him what was going on, and he said, you know anything, Clayton? I said, I know absolutely nothing. I told him what happened in that interview, and he said, You got a dollar? And I was thinking, no, I can get some money. He says, what do you got? And I said, well, I got four quarters in my pocket. He said, give me those four quarters. I gave him those four quarters, and he said, I'm now your attorney.
In February 2000, after Dennis Perry was arrested, the prosecutor in the case, John Johnson, wrote to Tomlinson's lawyer. In the letter, John Johnson told Clayton's attorney about how happy the family of Harold and Thelma Swain had been to learn that Dennis Perry had been arrested, and he included a copy of the indictment. He then wrote,
Tomlinson is, of course, a material witness in our case because Perry has attempted to use him to corroborate an alleged alibi. Your client has been truthful and assisted us in refuting this alibi. When we get ready to try this case, we will have to arrange for his transportation to Georgia. I am writing you because I believe your client can help us some more. I believe, based on comments he made to the Camden County officers, that Tomlinson knows more about what happened than he admits to. Specifically, I believe that Tomlinson had driven his motorcycle to Georgia for his mother's birthday weekend and wound up bringing Perry down to Camden County the weekend of the murders. There is some evidence that a second person was seen running away from the church where the murders occurred, and they did not fit the description of Perry. I also believe that Perry told Tomlinson what happened, what he did. Can your client help us more? I would appreciate your contacting him and talking with him about what I would like. If he can help, I would appreciate your contacting me and us talking about it.
I have no idea what John Johnson's referring to here when he says that Clayton Tomlinson helped refute Dennis Perry's alibi, because there's zero record of Clayton doing anything like that. And I also have no idea what John Johnson's referring to when he talks about there being a second person running from Rising Daughter Baptist Church after the murder. Because as far as I'm aware, there is no witness who ever saw anything like that. Which makes me wonder what the real point of this letter is. I don't see how John Johnson could really believe that Clayton Tomlinson could in any way have been useful to the state's case. In which case, could it have been that John Johnson was concerned more that Clayton Tomlinson could have helped Dennis Perry's case and was perhaps suggesting to him that should he return to Camden County, that he himself could be a target of the prosecution? Maybe. And if so, then perhaps the plan worked, because neither Clayton Tomlinson nor his mother, Donna Nash, were ever called by the defense at Dennis Perry's trial. And the jury never heard a word about Donna Nash's birthday or the hat rack alibi. While Deputy Dale Bundy and Prosecutor John Johnson both seemed to have believed that it was Clayton Tomlinson who was Daniel Perry's accomplice slash accessory, the whole story doesn't make that much sense. Clayton was only home on leave for a week, and he was trying to spend as much time as possible with his friends and family. The idea that he'd leave everyone for a few of those days that he had home to make a motorcycle trip down to Camden County, where he didn't have any ties whatsoever, well, it doesn't really square with what we know. And it's not consistent with what anyone recalls about how Clayton Tomlinson spent that first week home on leave. Sure, maybe he could have done it as a favor to Dennis, but there's no one who recalls Clayton disappearing for a few of those days. And besides, it's also not what the state's own witness remembers. Dennis's girlfriend Buzz, aka Carol Ann, had told Deputy Bundy that the motorcycle trip that she remembered hearing about, that Dennis Perry told her about, hadn't been a trip he made with some friend she'd never heard of and she'd never met. It had been a trip down with his brother Daniel. And Dennis Perry recalls something very similar. He recalls a trip with his brother down to Camden County on a motorcycle at some point around 1985.
Dennis doesn't know when exactly this might have happened, but he thinks he did make a trip to Camden County with his brother once where they had taken his brother's motorcycle. Doesn't really have a firm idea of the timeline, though. He thinks getting toward the spring or summer because it wasn't cold out, but of course in Georgia that doesn't really rule out much of the year. And it was sometime after he'd hurt his back, so it would have been in 1985 or later, but he thinks he and Carol Ann were still dating at the time, because that's the whole reason he'd gone. His brother had been going down to see their grandparents, so Dennis had used the opportunity to make a trip down to see his girlfriend. Dennis remembers that as they were coming into town, before they got into their grandparents' place in Waverly, they'd stopped by the little Jiffy store in Glynn County where Carol Ann worked. Then, after she'd gotten off of work, they'd gone back to Dover Bluff where their grandparents lived and where Carol Ann also lived. Dennis thinks that Daniel spent the night in their grandparents' house, and he'd probably been a few doors down over at Carol Ann's place. But Carol Ann's memory, or at least what she testified to at trial, is that Dennis Perry had only made a phone call to her, not that she'd actually seen him in person. That's why he called in the first place, to tell her he was in town but that he couldn't actually visit her. Whereas Dennis remembers actually seeing her while in town for a brief trip with his brother.
Dennis Perry thinks that what might be going on here is that Carol Ann is remembering a different trip to Camden County altogether. One that wasn't in 1985 at all. There was a different time he tried to come visit Carol Ann back in September of 1984, but he hadn't quite made it. Dennis had rented a car so that he could drive down from Jonesboro to Waverly to see her. But then he'd had that wreck in Wayne County and totaled the rental car. His mom had to drive all the way down as well to bail him out of that one, and then she drove him down to Waverly to his grandparents' place, but they hadn't stayed for long. Dennis Perry remembers that during the brief stop at his grandparents', he called his girlfriend just to say hi, but after all the problems he caused with the wrecked car and then needing his mom to drive down and bail him out, well, he was keeping a low profile. And he was only at his grandparents' until his mom decided it was time to leave and drive them back to Jonesboro, and that's why he could only call to say hi. That's what Dennis Perry remembers anyway. And if that's the event Carol Ann is remembering, it might explain a lot about what happened here and why Carol Ann remembers what she does. Because if Carol Ann had been expecting Dennis to visit her that weekend, well, it makes sense that Dennis would have needed to call her and at least give her an update on the fact that he wasn't going to be able to make it. And it would explain why Dennis would have been in Camden County, just a 2-minute walk from his girlfriend, and still not been able to go see her. Because after totaling the car his mom rented for him and, well, having her come all the way down to Wayne County to get him, he was pretty much doing whatever she told him to do. He was just stopping by his grandparents with her, and whenever she decided it was time to leave, he had to leave too. But that wreck was in September of 1984, long before the Swains were actually murdered, and there definitely had not been any motorcycles involved. Still, Carol Ann was never asked about these phone calls from Dennis Perry until 1998, so it at least seems possible that her memory might be conflating two different events. Maybe in reality there was a trip where he wrecked the rental car and he'd called Carol Ann to tell her he couldn't come see her, and maybe there was also a motorcycle trip with his brother sometime in 1985. It's a good theory for explaining what Carol Ann and Dennis remember anyway.
The only problem with the theory is that that's not how Dennis's brother Daniel remembers it. Daniel Perry knows that Dennis recalls him taking a trip like this, but he's kind of skeptical that it happened.
And you don't think there's ever a time you and Dennis went back to Camden together on a motorcycle?
We may have. He said that he thinks he remembers that.
And Daniel definitely doesn't remember taking Dennis Perry to Camden County on the weekend of March 10th, 1985.
It was suggested at one point that you had taken him down to Camden County that weekend, or weekend before.
Right, and that was impossible because I would have known that.
But well, did you ever go back to Camden County in that time period?
No, I was in the service up until, and I was stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, up until the 26th of February, and the murders happened, what, the 12th of March?
11th, yeah.
11th, okay.
Even if Daniel Perry doesn't remember him and his brother taking this motorcycle trip down to Camden County so that Dennis could see his girlfriend, there is at least one part of Carol Ann's stories that does sound familiar to him. Specifically, it's the part of Carol Ann's story that has Dennis telling her that he'd broken into his grandparents' house after coming down to Camden County. That story is something that Daniel remembers, only in his memory, that's a story about something that happened to him.
I kind of remember after they reminded me that we went down to my grandmother's and they weren't home. We know where the key is in the back. So I went in.
There hadn't been any break-ins at Susie and Zeke Wilson's house or anything like that. Not like how Carol Ann seems to recall it. According to Daniel Perry, what had actually happened was something much more normal. At some point, Daniel had taken a trip down to Camden County to see his grandparents, but when he'd gotten there, he discovered his grandparents had gone out of town, probably to Jacksonville, and they weren't at home. So Daniel had let himself into his grandparents' house with a hidden key he knew how to find, and he stayed there for the night before returning back home. So Daniel does remember something kind of like that happening, and while Daniel doesn't have a clear memory of this being a trip involving Dennis to go see his girlfriend, he also doesn't specifically remember this not being what happened either.
I guess he might have seen Carol Ann at that time, you know, but I don't know when that was. I don't remember that.
And after hearing about some of the other details about this trip to see Carol Ann that possibly happened, Daniel does kind of remember something like that happening, maybe. Or at least at some point, it does seem like there was a trip he took with Dennis, and during the trip, they had gone to see Dennis's girlfriend.
So the story I've heard is that at some point, y'all got on a motorcycle and came down, And on your way into town, you stopped at her workplace, like a Jiffy or something, where she worked.
That's right. That's right.
That sounds familiar?
Yep.
That girlfriend would have to be Carol Ann. And while there's not too much about the trip that Daniel recalls now, his memory is sort of in line with what Dennis remembers about it, more or less.
You kind of remember seeing her at the store before you got in there, or on the way into town?
Yeah, I probably did. And I remember what she looks like. She has I think it was like bleached blonde hair and kind of short. Mm-hmm. And she was a little stocky. I remember her, and I don't know why he was interested in her. You know, I came from that area, and I knew kind of what, you know, I knew somebody that knew her. Let me just say that.
So it's at least possible that the two trips Daniel kind of remembers, the one where he went to Camden County only to discover that his grandparents weren't home, and the one where he and Dennis stopped in at a Jiffy store on their way into Camden County, are actually one and the same trip. That there was one trip that Daniel and Dennis took together to see Carol Ann, and on that same trip, Daniel and Dennis had arrived at their grandparents' house only to discover that their grandparents weren't home, and they'd had to use a spare key to let themselves in. The story was told to Carol Ann and morphed into the story about a break-in at the grandparents' place. And if such a trip did happen, it seems like it was probably in the spring or maybe summer of 85. At the very least, it had to be after February 26, when Daniel got out of the military. It's not definitive, but to the extent the memories and statements of Dennis and Daniel and Carol Ann can sort of be correlated, that's the best way that I can make them all fit together. But as for exactly when that trip happened, well, from the existing record and the case files from the state and the defense, I don't think it's possible to give an exact date, other than to say it was probably in the first half of 85. There are a few more bits and pieces to draw from in the record, like a phone call that a defense investigator made to Carol Ann in August of 2000. There's a transcript of that call still. Carol Ann tells the defense investigator pretty much the same thing she says at trial. Yes, she'd gotten a phone call from Dennis one weekend, but no, she doesn't recall exactly when it was. And besides, she'd always thought that Dennis was in Atlanta when the murders happened. Anyway, she says, she told investigators that maybe they could hypnotize her, and maybe then she could remember. But they told her, nah, they can't do that. And that means if Carol Ann was telling the truth here, that Carol Ann had directly informed state investigators that she didn't know the date of when Dennis had made that phone call. That she was trying to remember it, but that she didn't and couldn't. But if Carol Ann did tell the state's investigators that, none of them ever wrote it down. Instead, investigators wrote down that Carol Ann had told them that the call had happened on precisely March 10, 1985, with no indication whatsoever that she had also asked to be hypnotized in the hopes that maybe that could help her remember a date she didn't actually remember. Given how incomplete the record is of Carol Ann's statements, that leaves only one real option for finding out the whole story from Carol Ann about that phone call from Dennis Perry and what she remembers. And that's to hear it from Carol Ann herself. So I went to the same trailer that Dale Bundy had once gone to 20 years before and knocked on the door, and Carol Ann answered. When I told her why I was there, she told me she didn't hardly know anything about the case, and she couldn't imagine what she had to say that I'd be interested in hearing. But she agreed to talk, and I asked her, do you remember if Dennis Perry called you on March 10th, 1985? Carolyn laughed and said, do you remember the dates when someone visits you? I have no idea. She was almost scoffing as she said it, which, well, fair enough, because from her perspective, it must have seemed pretty ridiculous to have some lady show up on her doorstep and ask her if she could please recall the exact date of some random phone call she'd once received decades ago from an ex-boyfriend. Of course she couldn't. But as we were talking about the phone call, she told me something that, as far as I'm aware, or at least as far as I've ever seen recorded, she's never included in any statement before. Because when I told her that in her testimony she'd said that Dennis Perry had called her one day and told her he couldn't stay, that he had to get back to Atlanta, she told me, no, that wasn't a phone call. That was the time he came by my job. He'd come down here to get something, I think, I don't know what. His brother brought him down, but then he'd had to turn around and get back to Atlanta. That happened after the murder, though. And that story from Carol Ann sounded an awful lot like the story Dennis had told me about the time he and his brother had gone down to Camden County and they'd stopped by the Jiffy store to see Carol Ann. There's no record of that story anywhere that I've seen in the files, and there's no way for Carol Ann and Dennis to have talked about the story or to have learned it from one another. Which means this seems to be an independent memory that both of them have of a time that Dennis's brother took him down to Camden County one weekend. And that weekend, Carol Ann felt very sure, had been after the murders, not before. And she was confident in the timing because she recalled joking around about a composite image that was hanging up at the convenience store where she was working, and about how it kind of looked like Dennis. It was a composite image of the man who'd shot Harold and Thelma Swain, which would definitely place this trip to Camden County after the murders and not before. 33 years later on, I've resigned myself to the fact that I'll probably never be able to figure out exactly what weekend in 1985 two brothers happened to drive a motorcycle down to Camden County to visit their grandparents. But I also feel confident now that the answer to the question doesn't actually matter, because there's no reason whatsoever to think that trip really happened on March 10, 1985. And there's no reason to think it was in any way connected to the murders at Rising Daughter Baptist Church. The evidence that Dennis Perry had been in Camden County the weekend before the murders had been one of three major pieces of evidence that the state had had against him when he was arrested for the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain. The other two pieces were the eyewitness identifications by Cora Fisher and Manzola Williams, and the statement of Jane Beaver about Dennis Perry confiding in her about his plans to commit the murders. All of this evidence was first obtained by Deputy Dale Bundy in July of 1998, during the first four interviews he conducted in the case. But there was also a fourth major component of the state's case, one that the state didn't have until after his arrest on January 13, 2000. That part of the state's case is based on statements that Dennis Perry made to investigators during an interrogation, and it either proves everything or nothing at all. Because the investigators say that Dennis Perry pretty much confessed to the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain, and Dennis Perry says that he did not. Next time on Undisclosed. Thanks for listening to episode 4 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Dennis Perry. We're off again this week for addendums, but we'll be back next Monday with episode 5. Methil Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Audio production is done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the Crime Writers On podcast. You can find out more about Dennis's case at the Georgia Innocence Project's website at georgiainnocenceproject.org. And huge thanks to GIP intern Ed Kostikian for his assistance on this case. You can find case-related materials, timelines of key events, and witness charts on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. You can also find transcripts of this episode and other episodes there, prepared by our transcribing team, Britta Bliss, Erica Fladell, Don Lugas, and Skylar Park. And thanks so much to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. Don't forget to follow us online. On all our social media accounts, our handle is UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any listeners out there have information on Dennis Perry's case you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.